Welcome to Still Scared Talking Children's Horror, a podcast about creepy, spooky, and disturbing children's books, films, and TV. I'm Ren Wednesday, my co-host is Adam Wybray. Today we're talking about the anime The Promised Neverland. A transcript of this episode will be available, so check the show notes for that. Enjoy! Good evening, Adam.
Good evening, Ren. That was a very gentlemanly way of saying it, I feel. I feel like I've been delicately introduced. Good evening. How are you feeling?
Good. I have not the most prepared I've ever been. I have just finished watching the series that we're talking about. So on the one hand, it's fresh in my mind. On the other hand, I'm a bit last minute.
You made the exact sound I imagine a squiggly face smiley makes. And when I got back into my laptop, really is, I've talked about Franken laptop before, held together by plate metal put into place and screwed on by my dad after the hinge broke, and this laptop really is on its last legs now, so the screen just goes black occasionally as it fancies, but I feel generally quite guilty about buying electronic devices even though I try to get them second hand, so I'm really putting off getting a new laptop. But anyway, what happened, listeners, is that my laptop screen went black. I said to Ren that I had to put the screen down, which means disconnecting the call and then putting it back up. And I reconnected. And Ren was, I don't want to say squawking, that sounds really rude, but it was in the middle of quite an arresting sound. But you say you were doing your Duolingo, which I don't think means doing an impression of Duo, I imagine. What were you practicing?
Oh, well, German, as ever. We're currently talking about the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Oh, wow. I mean, your German must be, fall of the Berlin Wall, pretty advanced, because I remember you reading Goethe in German when we were at university, like slogging through elective affinities.
Yes, I wouldn't say I understood every word. It was more of a overall impression of the Goethe that I was getting. But I did read a fair bit of Goethe in German.
So, I mean, this is much better than my Czech, where I could probably say, like, I have a potato.
I mean,
it's all you need, but still.
Yeah. Speaking of potatoes, I don't know. I don't think there are any potatoes.
Sorry, I think that's an audacious transition.
If we were watching Attack on Titan, I know there's like a potato subplot. And
really, is there?
There's one of the characters who's really into potatoes. Oh. Like, her whole thing is like eating potatoes.
Oh, cool. Maybe I'll have to watch Attack on Titan. I should probably mention it in my anime.
Which I have been thinking about because it also has a high wall in it.
Yeah. I should probably mention it in my animated horror book because, like, those giants are pretty grotesque, right? The cannibal giants.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually kind of, I actually had to stop watching it because I found it too grotesque.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah.
I mean, has it got BFG energy, Attack on Titan?
I would say it has BFG energy, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So we are talking about another anime. It's been a while. And manga. So I've read quite a few volumes of the manga. Did you just watch the anime?
Yes.
Of The Promised Neverland.
The manga ran from 2016 to 2020, apparently, and the anime started in 2019. We've only watched the first series because apparently it gets bad.
Yeah, it's almost universally slated. I think it tries to compress a lot of the latter part of the manga into just one season. And that can really kill an adaptation. Like, one of my favourite visual novels of all time is Umineko, which I think probably is the best visual novel. Which is quite a claim, but to be honest, there are a lot of bad visual novels.
Yeah.
Like, it is a bit like saying, what's the best PowerPoint presentation? Which is Daniel Hayes's PowerPoint adaptation of Jeff Brundle's Computer in the Fly, where he replicated the whole computer in PowerPoint form, creating a PowerPoint that was too big, really, for his laptop to load without crashing. But still, it was the best PowerPoint I've ever seen by a long, long way.
Yeah.
It was incredible. Like I think about it quite regularly, because I it's the pinnacle of the form, frankly. but anyway, Umineko is the pinnacle of visual novels, but the anime's rubbish, because, like, the visual novel was about, I don't know, as long as... I think someone worked it out, and it's basically the same as reading The Hobbit, The Silmarillion, and Lord of the Rings 2.5 times through, or something.
Wow.
It's very long, and the anime is not. And I think the same to a lesser extent with The Promised Neverland. It's a long manga, and I think it compresses a lot into a short form, the second season, and as such, kind of flattens out a lot of the nuances of the characters and rushes the plot, apparently. So I know a bit of what happens later, but I'm actually not that interested. I think this works as a really good self-contained, almost prison break narrative. So do you want to explain what The Promised Neverland is about?
Yeah, so there'll be spoilers for the whole of the first season. We always kind of spoil things, but I never really mention it, but because I don't really care about spoilers.
I think we're similar. I used to really upset my film students, and I upset my secondary school students actually with it too. Really annoys me because it upset them with Romeo and Juliet. They're like, oh, you said they're gonna die. So it says it in the prelude. It says it in the introductory monologue. It says these star-crossed lovers are going to die. Pay attention.
our settings is this: in this orphanage, 38 siblings. They're not actually related, but they grew up together as siblings. They're all numbered with a 5-digit tattoo on their necks. All of them will leave before they turn 12, but no one who leaves the orphanage, ostensibly going to a foster family, ever sort of writes back, and they never hear from them again.
It's because they're having such a nice time.
Because they're having such a lovely time, yeah. And it's this kind of sort of quite pastoral setting, these sort of scenic grounds, but there's also this... their learning system is quite high tech and sort of a bit, looks a bit sort of Minority Report-esque. So there's this sort of combination of sort of old-fashioned setting sort of technology as well.
But they seem to be having quite a lovely time. And I think, I mean, I guess the manga takes slightly longer with this than the anime. And so it's maybe a bit more convincing on this front. But, like, the kids look small. I mean, one thing I appreciate here is that the toddlers look like toddlers, right? There are some pretty adorable, chibi little kids in this.
Oh, yeah, little chibis.
And, yeah, in the opening chapter, they're, like, frolicking about, playing games and tag and hide and seek, and they're really affectionate with each other. I think it does a pretty good job at establishing this as, at first, a safe and happy place. Like, you never quite buy into it, because, you know, picking up, you probably know it's a horror manga. But, I don't know, it worked for me. I genuinely, there's something seductive about it, and the kids look so cute. Yeah, I don't know. To me, even knowing that something bad was going to happen, I kind of bought it.
Yeah, and I feel like maybe the setting of the house can kind of go both ways, because it's quite, in one sense, it's sort of quite gloomy, and like it's all sort of dark wood and kind of corridors and sort of big heavy doors. But on the other hand, it can be quite charming and sort of farmhouse-esque kind of. Yeah. There are protagonists who are sort of the oldest kids. They're 11. Norman, who is white-haired and intellectual. Ray, who is like dark-haired and cynical. And Emma, who is orange-haired and enthusiastic. And they are the top of the class. As they have these tests. So they had to test their intellectual capacity, and those three are always top of the class. They have been told never to go to the fence or the gate that are past the woods where they live, because it's dangerous.
Yeah. Has a very clear kind of boundaried setting that you know is going to get crossed in the same way that you get in fairy tales, right? A bit like Bluebeard, and there's one room that the wives cannot go into, and you know that they're going to try to get into that room, or don't stray from the path, and the kid's going to stray from the path.
But they so far, when they start, it doesn't seem like they have, but then little Connie, I think she's about six, is being adopted. So they're saying goodbye to Connie, and she promises to write when she leaves. She'll never forget about them. And she's dressed in her little boater hat, little blazer. And
and you know, it's important here, right, that the artist and that the animators in the anime really sell Connie as adorably cute, and they do.
But she's forgotten little bunny.
It's awful. There's this really cute little bunny teddy.
So Emma and Norman run after them to so that Connie doesn't leave without little bunny. And they go past the gate, and they find an extremely dead Connie in the back of a truck, with some kind of flower growing out of her chest. It's a kind of blood red hydrangea, I think. No sooner do they see that than they
and holy heck, that's my texture of the week. So let's just out the way texture of the week, because that there is mine. So texture of the week. And listener, I gasped. I think I read the manga first, I think, before I watched the anime. Yeah. So you get, I believe, I don't know if, I'm trying to remember if it's a full splash page, but it is a, you turn the page and you see this very young, very dead child with a flower sort of rupturing, sort of sprouting really unpleasantly out of her body. And I don't know, I just wasn't expecting something that nasty. And obviously I've read The Drifting Classroom, and, you know, The Drifting Classroom was also written for young teenagers, and again, it has a lot of child death. So, like, I was aware going into it that Drifting Classroom was from the 1970s, so I was aware that there have been decades of manga, you know, written for pretty young readers, at least young teenage readers, that probably go harder than you would expect in Western comics, basically. Mm. That, you know, are more graphic or certainly more willing to kill off young children. But it still got me. Like, I don't know why, but I just wasn't expecting such a cute, such a young child to be killed that quickly.
Yeah.
And yeah, to see it like that, like, it genuinely shocked me. How about you?
Yeah, no, me too. I wasn't, yeah. I think it's just, it's so abrupt.
Yeah. And
it's like no ceremony.
No, I think that's it. It's like, just, it's there. Yeah. And there's no kind of real, yeah, it's a really vertiginous moment. But it's the most gory image, but yeah, I genuinely found it very shocking. That's partly why. So, you know, I do think this is a horror series. Narratively, say it works more like a kind of Prison Break narrative, yeah. You know, and it's quite thrillery, I suppose, despite these supernatural elements. But because that happened so early, it just feels like all bets are off after that. You're like, right, any of these characters can get killed and it can get nasty. And so after that, it just creates this incredible sense of fear and tension, because you just know it's a completely merciless universe they're living in.
Mm.
So yeah, possibly a bit of an exploitative narrative mood, but it basically makes the whole rest of it work, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did... Yeah. I can't remember what the film was, but I remember, like, watching, like, a film about, like, and it was one of these ones where, like, the rich people have gone to live on a planet or, like, a moon or something, and down on Earth everything's kind of, you know, very dystopian.
Mm.
But there was, like, a point in the film where, like a child was, like, about to die.
Yeah.
Or, like, and, like, they didn't kill the child, and it was, like, a real narrative cop-out. It was like, this would have been so much stronger if you just killed that child. So, I mean, yeah, gotta respect the absolute willingness to just kill the child.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Narratively.
Yeah, narratively, it can be really effective, because it can give you that sense of, this is unsafe, right? That is not going to play by rules of certain characters are too young to die. Like, for me, seeing Hereditary in the cinema, without wanting to spoil it too much for anyone who hasn't seen it, but it's the only film where I've sworn out loud in the cinema... if people have seen it, they'll probably know which scene I mean. But
I haven't seen it, but I know the moment you're talking about.
Yeah, and I just wasn't expecting it. You know, I thought that the film was playing by certain rules, and then it wasn't. And after that, I found it so much scarier, because I was like, I have no idea what's going to happen. That I don't know. I don't know what set of rules this is playing by now, and. Yeah, I think for me, that's why then mother and the other kind of adult figures, or seemingly adult figures, you know, it's whether they're adults or whether they're demons is, you know, kind of unclear from the reader's perspective for a lot of it. You know, why they're so frightening. I mean, that does get resolved, but, you know, at first you're not quite sure exactly what or who these adults are. But, you know that they are willing to kill our main characters. I don't know, for me, say the Demon Headmaster, which obviously I love, you're never quite sure if the Demon Headmaster would be willing to do that. I feel like he's clearly willing to do it indirectly, to put the kids, like, say, with a shoveling stone. He's clearly willing to put the kids in very unsafe situations. And his minions are willing to do it. But with the Demon Headmaster, you get the sense that he doesn't want to get his hands dirty, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I guess it's an interesting question. How threatening should you make the antagonists in a piece of children's horror? but yeah, at this point the demons are also introduced. So do you have a texture?
It's a bit of an odd one, but like a kind of Sister Crone sort of evil pirouetting. We'll talk about her. She's a character. she's a very, very flamboyant in her movements, and sort of talks to herself about her kind of plans, and she's obviously kind of sort of meant to come across as, you know, like a bit insane.
Yeah.
Like, whereas the mother is sort of very, very buttoned up, but Sister Crone is much more, flamboyantly sort of unhinged.
Yeah, it's very much a kind of lawful evil and chaotic evil.
Yeah.
Who end up somewhat plotting against each other. The mother, as you say, is very much this sort of fascist authority figure, whereas Sister Crone, is clearly meant to be unhinged, basically. And is much more of a cackling villain, I suppose.
Yes. But, like, sort of the way she sort of dances and pirouettes in this sort of reverie of her schemes, I guess, I found quite...
She's kind of appealing.
Classic villain.
It's really tricky because, I mean, we will talk about her more, but she's a really problematic character. But she's also kind of likeable for some reason. I kind of liked her more. I mean, how do you feel about the kids here? I like Emma. I think, you know, the kind of... I guess it's that sort of enthusiastic tomboy kind of character. Like, you know, you get an Edith Blyton, and I mean, I don't think this is going off Edith Blyton, but, what's that awful one that I had to be interviewed about as a kid, and I said I didn't like it very much. Sent Suffolk, and they're on boats. Swallows and Amazons. But yeah, you know, she's kind of a bit of a classic children's book character, you know, sort of Anne of Green Gables, Pippi Longstocking, this kind of red-haired, enthusiastic character who can be a bit brash, but yeah, her heart's in the right place. And, you know, she's a likeable character.
I agree.
I mean, the three main kids aren't their archetypes, and the impression I get from the manga is that their characters get a lot more interesting as the manga progresses because they're put in more difficult, compromising moral situations, and some of them have to make some very difficult decisions, and then, you know, the characters become more complicated. But at this point they're very much little kids still, and I think they're fairly straightforward.
Norman's sort of quite preternaturally intelligent. He's just a genius boy. And quite a pretty selfless as well.
Yes, yeah, he's a pretty lawful, good, you know, pure good character, basically.
Yeah. And then, yeah, Ray's the sort of a bit of an edgelord.
Yeah, a bit of an emo.
Yeah. but, yeah. He's all right.
Yeah, I mean, the characters are fine. I don't think at this stage of the series, actually, I don't think it's really about character. I think it's about plot. And that's unusual for me to like, because I'm not normally that interested in plot. Mm. But I feel like this plot is so well-paced and so well-structured that I just found it really addictive. So... Mm. This is the point, obviously, where you realise, right, they're going to have to get out of this fake orphanage, right? The kids
are
being killed.
I don't think we've mentioned, that the kids are being killed by demons. They are a luxury good. They are human meat, raised on this farm and sold as a... Well, their brains in particular are sold as a delicacy to demons and... soon there will the this demon that they overhear says there will be some high quality ones, which means Norman, Emma, and Ray. So it's quite a lot for them to take in this first episode. But even from the beginning, Emma is adamant that they're all going to survive. Like all of the kids are going to get out of this orphanage, this fake orphanage.
What did you think of the demon design? Because they're weird-looking creatures.
I'm trying to think, what do they look like?
There's a slightly...
Big tongues.
Yeah, it's kind of elongated. To me, they look quite stone-like, almost. Hmm. Like, they're not as... they have these fleshy tongues, but their heads kind of look like often these sort of elongated or ovoid stones. Sometimes their eyes are kind of positioned oddly, like one above the other one. And then they have these very long, slightly tendril-like claws.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you don't see a lot of them in the anime.
I think you see more of them in the manga.
Mm.
They're quite odd-looking. Like, it's unusual design. I think they are quite creepy. I like that they look alien. You know, you can... They seem like they are a completely different species to the humans.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. Did you ever read the novel that Under the Skin, the film's based on? The Michael Farber?
No.
One. Okay, so that's about aliens harvesting humans for meat, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So it follows the main character, who's an alien, who's sort of disguised as a human woman as she harvests humans. And then, you know, we get the kind of farm where the humans are kept. And, you know, it works very effectively as vegan propaganda, basically. But, yeah, one thing I liked about that is you get a description of the aliens and this sort of four-legged... I don't know, it's hard to quite imagine them, but they seem almost like kind of shaggy-haired deer or something.
Mm.
Like sort of long leg, but sort of longer legs. And then the main character, this alien, she has to kind of undergo these surgical procedures in order to allow her to go undercover as a human, right? So she has to kind of, undergo this serious surgery in order to be able to disguise herself. And I don't know, I kind of... It'd be interesting if they'd done something similar with the demons here, maybe, if the demons had to kind of bridge the gap. And the demon realm, at this stage at least, of the manga, and you see less of it in the anime, it's kept very separate from the human realm.
Mm.
And on one level, I think that works because you get the idea of the demons as this sort of shadowy them, like this conspiratorial force who are far above the humans, and that these kids are like little rats in a maze or something, or mice in a maze, and the demons just so far above them. But at the same time, to a degree, it removes them as a threat. There isn't actually that much in the first season of the anime of, after that first sort of initial terrifying moment where they have to hide from the demons as they discover the corpse, there's very little to memory, right, of the kids and the demons in close physical proximity at this stage.
Mm. Yeah.
I think there's quite a lot of that later on, and the demons are more complicated, and you get factions and some demons who are ideologically opposed to eating humans, like you get vegetarians and vegans and so on. But you don't really get that at this stage.
Yeah.
You know, the main antagonists here are these two adult humans.
Yeah. Yes. So the mother kind of, she's tall, so very neat, uniformed. She kind of, you're not quite sure if she's human, like at first, because she does sort of seem like it could be a costume kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
She's just, outwardly very, very caring and to the children, but then at the end of episode two, Sister Crone turns up for it's like more security, because the mother sort of realizes that Emma and Norman went to the gate, should we talk about Sister Crone?
Yeah. So, is Sister Crone the only black character?
I think so.
I think so too. And to be fair, I haven't read all of the manga, so it might be that there are more characters of colour introduced. I say characters of colour, I mean, obviously, this is ostensibly set in Japan, I guess. I think that becomes more apparent later. But, it's a Japanese series. But yeah, Sister Crone is the only black character.
Mm. Yeah, and so there's like a certain like grotesquery to the animation at times, and like particularly to the animation of her.
Yeah.
Where she looms a lot. There's a lot of there's a lot of kind of underneath kind of like, you know, view of her from underneath. But she's sort of shadowed and these things quite a lot. But it also like the way she's drawn, like her lips are very big, her eyes are very big.
Yeah.
It's very like, it's, you know, watching it, you're like, well, yeah, that is pretty reminiscent of, you know, racist caricatures, yeah. Really.
I think that's also maybe reinforced by the fact that she's in this mother role, and occasionally she looks somewhat like she has a maid or kind of nanny costume almost.
Mm.
And I think, okay, for a Western viewer, it maybe recalls a sort of mammy stereotype.
Mm.
But then I don't know whether that would be something a Japanese viewer would, you know, some Japanese viewers would be aware of. You know, obviously, there's going to be several Japanese viewers who have seen, say. It's that film I've never actually seen, Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
But definitely there is anti-black racism in Japan and blackface. Mm. And
yeah,
it does feel, at least visually, like the character is a racial caricature.
Yeah, I think probably visually more than, like, in terms of her behaviour.
I think, like, I would agree with that.
She's kind of, yeah, she's sort of quite flamboyantly mad, but and she has a little sort of little baby face doll that she talks to, and at one point she's sort of just talking to the kids, and she's kind of singing, like talk singing. so she's quite, like, yeah, quite an exuberant sort of villainous character.
Well, yeah, I on some level she's the character I like, is not quite the right word, but she brings a lot of energy to it.
Yeah,
that the mother character doesn't, because she's so kind of still, and yeah, and also she becomes perhaps at times more sympathetic, like mother.
Yeah,
I mean, there's some plot revelations that make her maybe a pitiful character, but still she's a hard character to feel much sympathy for, whereas I think with Miss Crone you do to a degree, like,
yeah, you find out in episode 7 that she has the tattoo on her neck, and she tells, I don't know, I think she's telling kids that, like, yeah, she's telling, like, Emma and Norman and Ray, yeah, girls who live to 12 have the chance to become a mother themselves, but they can never step outside the farm because they have this sort of auto-destruct device implanted in their chest. But yeah, she's an interesting character. Like, she's shown to be, like, intelligent. You know, she's, because she's sort of scheming. She wants to be a mother herself. So she's, like, sort of scheming against the mother of the house. Which she's sort of saying that she'll help the kids and kind of in exchange for getting ahead, kind of stuff. But, yeah. And she, I think she becomes pretty sympathetic, like, in her last episode.
Yeah.
The mother sort of realizes that Sister Crone has made this sort of bargain with the kids, and tells her, "Oh, you're going to be the mother at Plant 4. Like,
you're getting promoted.
You're getting promoted. Yeah. But in fact, she is goes to the gate and is the only person we actually see them being sort of impaled with this flower through the heart.
Yeah.
You know. And then we kind of get, like, as she's sort of dying, we get this kind of flashback of her life, like, in this world. And she says, "Oh, they were in it together. I had no chance of winning from the beginning." And I kind of wondered if there was a kind of, like, implication about race there, because it's kind of, it shows her in these flashbacks, and, like, how she's only always been the only kind of black person in her class, like in her orphanage, in the like mother training or whatever.
Yeah.
You know. And all the kind of striving she's had to do to get to even to the point of where she was, and how that's broken her, I guess.
I found that episode quite affecting.
Mm.
Like, it's definitely the episode I found the most moving.
Yeah.
I don't want to sort of outright defend it, because if someone else watches it and says, nah, this is racist and this is just, unpalatable, or just find it offensive or unpleasant, I wouldn't argue against that. I think there's an argument that it's trying to do something. Whether it succeeds, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that at least might be deliberate,
I think like visually, like it is like pretty dodgy,
and it's a shame because it doesn't need to be, right?
like
it'd be perfectly easy to have her as a character and not use any racial caricature,
and it doesn't, like, I thought that was interesting, like when you see her when she's younger in these flashbacks, she looks, it's much more just like straightforward, she just looks like a kid.
Yeah, like, she looks like the other characters, basically. Like, the style isn't different. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, you can't do it.
Yeah. I guess the other main narrative is the three kids, and they, recruit some other kids, but our three characters kind of working out the lay of the land, exactly what the rules are, the geography of the house. You know, there's a lot of kind of map work, basically. And precisely how they're going to escape.
Yeah, they realise they have trackers quite sort of early on, and they discover by kind of seeing, like, they got like a new baby gets delivered to the house, and they sort of like check on the baby, like where this tracker might be, and find it's like behind the left ear. So they know like kind of that they're being tracked and where it is, but they can't. But then, like, Ray is sort of working on something that will disrupt the trackers. And there's a lot of back and forth about whether they can really escape with all the kids, which Emma is adamant that they need to, but Ray's like, it's impossible. and Ray himself is an interesting character, is an interesting position. So Norman kind of, they realize that there is a traitor in the house somewhere, someone's feeding information to the mother, and Norman sort of lays a little trap and finds out that it's Ray, but then it turns out that Ray's like an extra double inside traitor where he's giving information to the mother, but he's only doing that so they can get more information on like how to escape.
That stuff's pretty fun. And then they start to kind of train up the younger kids under the guise of just play, in order to get them ready for the escape, which I quite enjoyed.
Yeah.
You get sort of montages of them obstacle coursing their way through the forest.
Yeah, it's good. There's kind of bits of 3D animation in the series. I think, like, in the house, get, like, this dark, shadowy house with its doors and corridors, which I thought worked quite pretty
well.
Yeah,
well, I think it's a space that you end up knowing quite well, and it is an eerie space. Like, I think it, I like the way that it both feels like the kind of boarding school you might get idyllically presented in a kid's book, but also very sinister.
I
don't know, maybe like some of the school spaces in Diana Wynne Jones or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and they find a secret cellar room at one point that's sort of full of, like, the children who have been killed, like, keepsakes.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like Little Bunny, which is very, very upsetting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why I find the series interesting, right? Is that... So the Drifting Classroom, I guess, is different in as much as... I mean, the film's obviously very strange, but in terms of...
yeah.
Oh, yeah. very, very strange. But the manga, there's just peril all the way through, right? There's not much time for hijinks in the Drifting Classroom manga, because it's just peril upon peril upon peril. It never lets up, which...
Upon elaborate... time traveling schemes,
yeah, like it's just relentlessly like dense, right? And on some level that's amazing. Like, I love it because there's something really hysterical about that, and ridiculous and bizarre, and I love that. Like, it's always turned up to 11, but it also takes the edge off the horror because it's just constant. Whereas what I find interesting about The Promised Neverland is they are... It'd almost be easy for the kids to kind of slip into pretending like everything's still okay. And that's what they have to do for the little kids. So they have to present this scheme to escape to the little kids as though it is just fun and games. And so the little kids are still adorably cute, and they're still laughing and smiling and having fun. And so I feel like there's this really interesting tension created between the facade, which they have to kind of on some level still keep, they have to keep it up. And so on some level, you're still getting quite a lot of cute imagery all the way through. Right?
Yeah.
So you have that, and then you have moments of really quite upsetting horror. Like you say, this basement room with the keepsakes of murdered children.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I find that really interesting, like, tonally, because...
It's got range.
It kind of does, like, because on some level it's a bit of a cozy watch, but it's also really super dark, like, quite shockingly dark for something clearly aimed towards... a kind of teenage or young teenage audience. Yeah, I don't know. I find that quite interesting. It's sort of a piece with other modern young adult fiction. Like, I think you could say the same thing really for The Hunger Games, which on some level is a kind of classic adventure story, you know, in as much as it's got characters working together to overcome odds, and it's got obstacles and fending of yourself in the wild, but it's also really, really bleak and upsetting and violent.
Yeah, it's got some, like, weird, nasty stuff in there as well. Like, I remember, like, I think it's in the first book, like Katniss and Peter are, like, trying to escape from, like flesh-eating hounds that, like, have the faces of, like, the dead kids.
Yeah. It's really up. Yeah, it's just like wild, unhinged body horror moments. And when one of the characters, like, I think, slowly gets ripped to pieces, I can't remember if that's the first or second book, but it's nasty, like properly nasty. And I guess I find that interesting because I think it used to be that you'd get that in Stephen King, say, like, clearly that's what Stephen King is doing in something like It. Mm-hmm. In as much as, yes, there's the horrible Pennywise, really nasty stuff with kids being murdered, but also there's a lot of kids on bikes nostalgia. But that, you know, Stephen King, yeah, okay, teenagers like Stephen King, but he was always marketed essentially as an adult writer.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas
yeah.
Hunger Games and Stranger Things, say, are clearly, really sold to a kind of teenage audience. Like, you know, lots of kids love Stranger Things. And it's interesting because I'm now finding, and obviously there's been a fair amount of moral panic over this, but lots of kids love Squid Game.
Oh, right.
Loads of kids in my school watch Squid Game.
Yeah.
But in a way, that's not surprising, right? Squid Game is only really one step up from the Hunger Games.
Yeah, yeah. It's got all this addictive structure, like, it's not surprising. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know, I just find it kind of interesting, the position that stuff aimed at a teenage audience now occupies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, same with films, right? Like, I can't remember, did you see The First Omen? It's like the prequel to The Omen, which came out last year.
Oh, no, I haven't.
It's really good. I thought it was really good. Like, that's not the complete consensus, but personally, like, it was one of my favourite films of the year. I thought it was brilliant. But, yeah, there were some scenes in that, and one scene in particular, where I couldn't believe it was 15 rated. I was like, what are the BBFC thinking? That's wild. Yeah, like, I was astonished it wasn't 18 rated. Like, not quite to the degree of writing a letter to the BBFC, but almost. I don't know. I'm not, you know, it's not something I'm, like, massively concerned with. Like, listening to Evolution of Horror, lots of listeners on there who seem like well-adjusted, happy individuals talk about watching adult horror films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Halloween, etc. at a very young age.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a massive concern, but I do find it interesting in terms of marketing and what is seen as this is for, you know, that is aimed towards a younger audience, because I would have found The Promised Neverland very disturbing like a 12-year-old, maybe even 13-14-year-old, actually. Just in terms of how unsafe it feels at times.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, I've got, hypocritically, well, maybe not, I've got copies of the manga, and I have copies in my classroom, and, you know, kids have borrowed them and like it. Like, it's totally popular with the kids.
Yeah.
What did you think of it overall? Like, overall, do you like it?
I enjoyed watching just the first season as, like, a standalone thing, you know. Because you said it's bad, but also I'm kind of like, I don't really need to watch anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, they, you know, they escape. but it's a very, like, it's a very satisfying escape movie. Narrative.
Yeah. No, I feel exactly the same. It's funny, like, I know that there is a lot more world building in terms of, say, how this society came about, that there's some kind of war between the demons and the humans, and then there was a pact that was made that, you know, I think the demons leave the humans alone as long as a certain number of them are harvested, basically. And yeah, some demons are on board with this, others aren't. You know, there's the rich family who came up with the whole pact and who run the farms, etc. So, you know, all of this is kind of fleshed out and the characters get more complex. But, yeah, I'm not actually that interested in finding out about it. And I don't know why, because I do like it. It's not like, you know, there's some things, say Twin Peaks, for instance, which obviously, you know, has more going on, you know, it's a more complex series. But when Twin Peaks, for me, you know, and David Lynch obviously died a few weeks ago. And for me, there's never enough, like with Twin Peaks, you know, I've watched the series multiple times, but I've also, you know, bought Mark Frost's books. You know, I've read The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer. I've listened to whole podcasts on Twin Peaks. I've read countless think pieces and essays. It's something that I have spent, you know, hundreds of hours thinking about. And, you know, yeah. I want all that lore. I want to be able to... Yeah, whereas I don't feel like that with The Promised Neverland, even though I do like it. It's good.
Yeah, I mean, like, well, yeah, maybe it's something like a kind of short story, like where, because I write short stories sometimes, and I think, kind of speculative fiction short stories are sort of an interesting thing, because it's like you don't have a lot of space to do a lot of world building and like all the stuff you would do in a novel, kind of. But you want to get enough in there to make it sort of interesting and like to get a sense of what this world might be like and to tell your story within it, kind of thing. And I think this, yeah, the sort of first series does that quite well. It's like, I have a sense of this world. I don't know the details of it, but you know, it's
that's enough.
That's enough. Yeah.
But yeah, I think generally, you know, it's available on Crunchyroll here in the UK. If you're willing to put up with some short ads, or obviously not if you subscribe to Crunchyroll, and yeah, you know, I would recommend it. I think it's a satisfying thing.
Yeah, I would agree.
Cool.
I realized recently, this is not related, that there is they did a remake of The Witches in like 2020.
Didn't we discuss it?
No, I don't think so. Did we?
Didn't we? I've seen it. Oh. I didn't like it that much.
Oh.
I thought we... I don't know. Maybe we didn't.
Maybe I thought you were talking about the original one. I didn't, because I didn't even realise there was a new one.
No, I quite like the... I like the original.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, I mean, it's flawed, but I like it.
Yeah.
Like the one of Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
It's all right. It's not great.
Okay. All right. <Cool. laughs> We don't need to do it for the podcast then.
I don't know. I think, you know, there's always more obscure Roald Dahls. We need to do the Minpins, you know, or like Break Glass Elevator. We need to, yeah, that's what we need. Break Glass Elevator film. You know?
I'm not looking forward to going back to the Great Glass Elevator. That was such an atmosphere. That
I know, it's so weird. It's proper existential and ontological. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. But we absolutely should talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. You want to run the credits?
Yeah. Our intro music is by Maki Yamazaki. Our outro music is by Joe Kelly. Our artwork's by Letty Wilson. Still don't really know what I'm doing with the Twitter. I don't want to.
Yeah, it was awful, isn't it, Twitter? Yeah, like, I mean, we don't really use it anyway. Like,
no.
We don't like social media. Like, just email us.
No. Yeah. And I'll do the Instagram because I like doing my little collages. Yeah.
No, they're good.
Yeah.
What's our email again?
Oh, stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com. And do email us, because most of the emails are just spam and stuff, so it's like nice when we get an email from a human.
Yeah, yeah.
Even if it then takes us like 3 months to answer it. Cool. Do you have a sign off for us, Adam?
Oh yeah, Yama Brambo, creepy kids.
Oh.
It was, I have a potato in Czech.
Ich habe ein Kartoffel.
Bye.
Bye.